ನರಂಜನ ಯಮುನಾ ತೀರವನಚಾರಿ ಯಮುನಾ ತೀರವನಚಾರಿ ಜಯ ರಾಧಮಾಧವ ಇಂದ್ರವಿಹಾರಿ ಜಯ ಗೋಪೀ ಜನವಲ್ಲಭ ಗಿರಿವರಧಾರಿ ಯಶೋದನಂದನ ರಜ ಜನರಂಜನ ಯಮುನಾ ತೀರವನಚಾರಿ ಯಮುನಾ ತೀರವನಚಾರಿ ಜಯ ರಾಧಾ ಮಾಧವ ಇಂದ್ರವಿಹಾರಿ ಜಯ ರಾಧಾ ಮಾಧವ ಇಂದ್ರವಿಹಾರಿ ಜಾಯಂ ವಿಷ್ಣುಪಾದ ಪರಮಹಂಸ ಪರಿವಿರಾಜಕಾಚಾರ್ಯ ಅಷ್ಟೋತ್ತರ ಶತ ಶ್ರೀ ಶ್ರೀಮದ್ ಹಿಸ್ ಡಿವೈನ್ ಗ್ರೇಸ್ ಎಸಿ ಭಕ್ತಿ ವೇದಾಂತ ಸ್ವಾಮಿ ಶಿಲ ಪ್ರಭುಪಾದ ಕೀ ಜಾಯ್ ಅನಂತ ಕೋಟಿ ವೈಷ್ಣವ ವೃಂದ ಕೀ ಜಾಯ್ ಗ್ರಂಥರಾಜ್ ಶ್ರೀಮದ್ ಭಾಗವತಂ ಕೀ ಜಾಯ್ ಆಲ್ ಗ್ಲೋರೀಸ್ ಟು ದಿ ಅಸೆಂಬಲ್ ಡಿವೋಟೀಸ್ ಆಲ್ ಗ್ಲೋರೀಸ್ ಟು ದಿ ಅಸೆಂಬಲ್ ಡಿವೋಟೀಸ್ ಆಲ್ ಗ್ಲೋರೀಸ್ ಟು ಶ್ರೀ ಶ್ರೀ ಗುರು ಅಂಡ್ ಗೌರಾಂಗ ಓಂ ನಮೋ ಭಗವತೆ ವಾಸುದೇವಾಯ ಓಂ ನಮೋ ಭಗವತೆ ವಾಸುದೇವಾಯ ಓಂ ನಮೋ ಭಗವತೆ ವಾಸುದೇವಾಯ ಗ್ರಂಥರಾಜ್ ಶ್ರೀಮದ್ ಭಾಗವತಂ ಕ್ಯಾಂಟೋ 4 ಚಾಪ್ಟರ್ 29 ಟೆಕ್ಸ್ಟ್ 16 ಟೆಕ್ಸ್ಟ್ 15 ಡಸ್ ನಾಟ್ ಹ್ಯಾವ್ ಅ ಪರ್ಪೋರ್ಟ್ ಸೊ ಐ ವಿಲ್ ರೀಡ್ ದಿ ಟ್ರಾನ್ಸ್ಲೇಷನ್ ಸೊ ವಿ ಹ್ಯಾವ್ ಕಂಟಿನ್ಯೂಟಿ ಸೊ ಯೆಸ್ಟರ್ಡೇ ವಾಸ್ ಟೆಕ್ಸ್ಟ್ 14 ವೇರ್ ದ ಸಿಟಿ ಕಾಲ್ಡ್ ಗ್ರಾಮಕ ವಿಚ್ ಡಿಸ್ಕ್ರೈಬ್ಡ್ the genitals and rectum, and that continues here. It is said to text 15, when it is said that Puranjana goes to Vaishyasa, it is meant that he goes to hell. He is accompanied by Lubdhaka, which is the working sense in the rectum. Formerly I have also spoken of two blind associates. These associates should be understood to be the hands and legs. Being helped by the hands and legs, the living entity performs all kinds of work and moves hither and thither. Text 16. Antapura cha hridayam Vishuchir mana uchyate Tatra moham prasadam va Harsham prapnoti tad gunaihi ಅಂತಃಪುರಂ ಚ ಹೃದಯಂ ವಿಶುಚಿರ್ ಮನ ಉಚ್ಯತೆ ತತ್ರ ಮೋಹಂ ಪ್ರಸಾದಂ ವಾ ಹರ್ಷಂ ಪ್ರಾಪ್ನೋತಿ ತದ್ಗುಣೈಃ antahpuram cha hridayam vishuchir mana uchyate tatra moham prasadam va harsham prapnoti tad gunaihi. Go clear in the pool. Ladies, please. Antavpuram, private residence, cha, and hridayam, the heart, vishuchihi, the servant named Vishuchina, manaha, the mind, uchyate, is said, tatra, there, moham, illusion, prasadam, satisfaction, va, or harsham, jubilation, prapnoti, obtains, tat, of the mind, gunaihi, by the modes of nature. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada ki jai. We will also do text 17 because they are connected. The word antahpura refers to the heart. The word vishuchina, meaning going everywhere, indicates the mind. Within the mind, the living entity enjoys the effects of the modes of material nature. These effects sometimes cause illusion, sometimes satisfaction, and sometimes jubilation. Purport. The mind and intelligence of the living entity in the material existence are affected by the modes of material nature. And according to the association of the material modes, the mind is habituated to go here and there. The heart feels satisfaction, jubilation, or illusion according to the effects of the modes of material nature. Actually, the living entity in his material condition remains inert. It is the modes of material nature that act on the mind and heart. The results are enjoyed or suffered by the living entity. This is clearly stated in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 3, text 27. Prakrite kriyamanani gunai karmani sarvachah ahankara vimudhatma kartaham iti manyate. The bewildered spirit soul, under the influence of the three modes of material nature, thinks himself the doer of activities that are in actuality carried out by nature. Text 17. Yatha yatha vikriyate gunato vikarotiva tatha tathopadarshtatma tadvrittir anukaryate. Translation. Formerly it was explained that the queen is one's intelligence. While one is awake or asleep, that intelligence creates different situations. Being influenced by contaminated intelligence, the living entity envisions something and simply imitates the actions and reactions of his intelligence. Purport. The queen of Puranjana is described herein as intelligence itself. Intelligence acts both in the dream state and in the waking state, but it is contaminated by the three modes of material nature. Since the intelligence is contaminated, the living entity is also contaminated. In the conditioned state, the living entity acts according to his contaminated intelligence. Although he simply remains an observer, he nonetheless acts, being forced by a contaminated intelligence, which in reality is a passive agent. Om Ajnana Timirandhasya Gyananjana Salakaya Chaksur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamahyam Dadati Svapadantikam Vancha Kalpataru Vyashtra Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shavasadi Gora Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So we might keep it to a short class today because I have service in the kitchen. I gotta run. We'll see. In this two verses, Narada Muni is describing the mind and the intelligence. And the main point that's being described is that the mind and intelligence are affected by the three modes of nature. And they create these situations of happiness, distress, illusion. And the living entity, the soul proper, is in its inert condition. So whatever is the experience of happiness, satisfaction, illusion, suffering, it's all in the mind. And whatever is in the mind, that's what we accept as favorable condition or unfavorable condition. The soul actually is in its inert state. Of course, the experience is for the soul, no doubt. But the soul's active intelligence, the active mind, meaning the spiritualized mind and the spiritualized intelligence, are not awake. It is this artificial imposition is what it accepts as happiness or distress. And by that, all of one's experiences in this world are created. So the mind Prabhupada says, by the influence of the modes of nature, the mind is habituated to go here and there, and he feels satisfaction, jubilation or illusion according to the effects of the material modes of nature. So we understand from Bhagavad Gita that happiness is determined by the modes of nature. The quality of happiness is also determined by the modes of nature. Somebody who is influenced by the mode of ignorance experiences a whole different kind of happiness versus a person who's influenced by, whose mind is influenced by the mode of goodness. A person whose mind is influenced by ignorance, they're perfectly happy in a dirty, cluttered, unclean environment. They don't find anything wrong with that. In fact, it's perfect. A person whose mind is influenced by the mode of goodness finds it, you know, terrible. Cannot live in that condition. It's like, how can you live like this? And the person ignorance will say, how can you live any other way? There was a joke about a professor. He had his room, all his papers were all over the place, just complete mess and cluttered. And he was perfectly all right. One day his secretary walks into his office and says, oh, look at this room. And so she organizes everything nicely, cleans it up. All the papers are nicely stacked, the books are back, you know, everything is nice and clean. The professor comes in, looks at it, calls his secretary and says, what have you done? You've completely messed up my room. Now I cannot find anything. Because when it was cluttered, I knew exactly where everything was. And now you've completely ruined the whole thing for me. One man's food is another man's poison. What works for one does not work for another. However, for both these persons, the sense of happiness, the idea of suffering, is all in the mind. And the problem is, or the issue is, that ahankara vimodhatma karta aham iti manyate. That when the conditioning is that I am the doer, for me to be the doer, I have to have an identity. And my identity usually is, I'm a devotee, I am a man, I am whatever, I'm such and such person with such and such role to play. And I see the world from that perspective. That is the ahankara vimudatma. And by the way, it is so ingrained, it is so habituated, that unless the intelligence is active, one doesn't recognize what identity I'm seeing the world with. For example, throughout the day we go through and we perhaps are not conscious, what's my identity? Who is thinking all this? Last night in our Bhakti Vriksha, we had a group of 10 maybe, a good mixture of elderly or senior men and women. And they all know each other for about 30 some years. So they are very good friends. And there was some discussion from Ishopanishad, the reference to a verse in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says, Striya Vaishya Tata Shudras. Some reference to women, Vaishyas and Shudras. That the verse actually is that even they have access to pure devotional service. But anyway, the question was, why women are referred to in this way? Is it because women are inferior in some way? Either psychologically or biologically or sociologically? As soon as the question, I didn't even present it, someone presented it. You can guess it was a woman who presented it. As soon as she presented it, the whole room got polarized. Like that. And they know each other. And the first thing was a little taunt from here, a joke from there, something, you know. And suddenly you could see all the men defending their position as men. All the women defending their position as, no, they were great personalities like Mirabai. And someone will say, well, there's only one Mirabai, all the acharyas are men. Suddenly everything got polarized. Because they suddenly fell into this identity trap. I'm a woman, I'm a man. Until then they were all friendly and everything is fine. Oh, nice to see you, nice to see you. Suddenly it polarizes. So something happens and we become polarized. Because our sense of identity really awakens. A false sense of identity is brought to the forefront. It happens in many other ways as well, but I'll leave that to your imagination. But they have these identities. We all have these identities or masks, and we switch from one identity to another identity, from one to another, and that's how we see the world. And in all of this, the soul itself is inert. Just like, hey, what's going on? And the modes of nature are creating all these pictures for us, and we accept, yes, that's true. It's called illusion. And to make things worse, we have Puranjani, the intelligence. The intelligence, its real function is to check the mind. The real function of the intelligence is to tell the mind, I think you've got it all wrong. Your identity is not this. You're really a soul. Can you see it from the soul's perspective? And we need that to discern things clearly. You're not this body. That's an intelligent statement, or a statement that intelligence has to help us recalibrate ourselves. I haven't used that word in a long time. But it's an important faculty that puts the mind back in its place. But what happens is material intelligence, just like the material mind, takes a break, takes a very long break, almost resigned, if you will, from checking the mind. In fact, it partners with the mind to strengthen the misconception that the mind has. So when the mind says, oh, why are all women treated like this in scripture? The intelligence will say, I'll give you so many ideas why this is the case. Because somehow, somewhere, women are seen in this manner. And I will also show you how that is not true, how equality of sexes is something that's your birthright. Whatever, I'm just making it up, but you get the idea. Intelligence strengthens the misconception of the mind, material intelligence. So in the case of conditioned souls like us, even that material intelligence is of different grades. And we're tested on it, right? We go to school or we go through certain training just to kickstart that intelligence. We develop that intelligence. I mean, most people, that intelligence is not working. You know what's the basic level of intelligence called? It's called common sense. And most people, common sense doesn't work. Although the term is common sense, the word common is meant to imply that it's basic. But common also implies that most people should have it. It's not there. Basic common sense is not there. That's like the first indicator of intelligence. Then there is other degrees of intelligence, you know, ability to discern from something complex to make it or break it down to simple units. But the conditioned soul takes simple things and complicates it up. Which is also a function of intelligence, actually. I was hearing that the words in Sanskrit, there are two words, samasa and vyasa. Samasa means to take simple units and tie it all together into one complex unit called synthesis. That requires intelligence. And Vyasa means to take something very complex and break it down to analytically break it down to small pieces. Both require that kind of intelligence. However, regardless of whether one has this faculty or not, the real intelligence, the spiritual intelligence, is to check the mind. And this cannot awaken until one is on a track of Krishna consciousness. So the material intelligence can be very active in many people. They could analyze very complex situations, they could really think of very intricate pictures, envision something that's very intricate, they can verbalize it, draw it in pictures, they can do all of that. It is still material. Ahankara vimudatma. It is still material because they are acting on a different conception of their identity. So say it differently. Real intelligence, spiritual intelligence, is that which helps us understand our real identity. Not just once in a while, but on a daily operative basis. That is spiritual intelligence. It helps check us to see us from our real position. So for example, somebody said something, and the first thing is, why did they say like that? That's the mind, because the impressions are in the mind. The spiritual intelligence, when it is strong or awakened, will immediately kick in. Who are you? Who is hurt? Is it the false identity, or is it the soul that is hurt? Isn't this the argument Krishna puts forth in the Bhagavad Gita for Arjuna, right in the beginning? First he tells him, you're not this body. And then he says, while you still have not understood that you're not this body, there are pains and pleasures associated with the body. So first thing is, don't react, just tolerate. And a person who learns to tolerate puts himself on the track of eternal life. So avyaya amrita mashnute. That's the next verse. And then he says, your intelligence should awaken so you can look at spirit and matter side by side. That's what the great tattvadarshis do. They can see spirit and matter side by side. Because they understand that one has endurance and the other is temporary. That's how intelligence should kick in. But it doesn't. It doesn't because it is influenced by the modes of nature. So as long as the mind and intelligence are allowed to be under the nice influence of the modes of nature, one's suffering, happiness, satisfaction, illusion, they will continue. And they come at this so-called random order. Although nothing is random, the experiences are random. The same thing sometimes gives us happiness, and the same activity gives us misery. It all depends on how the modes of nature are acting at that moment. However, everything still ultimately gives us suffering. In the grand scheme of things, it's suffering because the soul is still conditioned. The first order of business is to uncondition the soul. We may do anything else in the world. You know, we may speak nicely, we may behave very nicely, we may be very dharmic, very moral in our behaviors, very ethical in our views. All of that is possible. Still the suffering will continue. Because the soul is not being released. Meaning one is not living one's life in a way to release the soul. So even the great moralists, the so-called very nice people in this world, they also go through terrible suffering, dejection. You know, great altruists, they go through severe dejection disappointment, because the real identity is still covered. And this is how the material intelligence and mind complicate the soul's existence in this material realm. That's how Puranjani works. In this case, Puranjani is material intelligence. The material intelligence completely subdues the mind. Well, I should say it differently. Completely subdues the living entity's ability to choose Krishna. And simply serves the dictates of the mind. In fact, it enamors the living entity. That's what Puranjana's whole situation is. He likes to lie down on the nice, gentle arms of Puranjani and gaze into her beautiful eyes. And whatever she says, he does. So the material intelligence will say, why struggle so hard for something that's not achievable? Try something that's achievable. That is something in this world. Oh, okay. Or another way the intelligence will act is, who knows what the future can hold for you? You should have some backup, something, some reserves. Oh yeah, that's true. Or another way the material intelligence will say is, hey, the Bhagavad Gita says that you should perform duties in certain activities and therefore you should do something like, it can bewilder in any way. So the real solution is to live on the basis of, I would say, borrowed intelligence for the moment. Or said differently, on the basis of higher intelligence. We live our life, or we should live our life, on the basis of intelligence provided in scripture. This is Krishna's intelligence. And Krishna's intelligence, because our intelligence is not wide awake, they don't match, or they match conditionally. I like this from the Bhagavad Gita, that, you know, I'm not there yet, Prabhu, I'm still neophyte, I cannot follow that instruction. I can follow this instruction, like that. It makes it very selective. So Krishna's intelligence and our material intelligence, they connect through the medium of the Guru's intelligence. Because the spiritual master and sadhus, they have fully, nicely taken that intelligence and they bring it to us in a way that our material intelligence can understand. Sometimes our material intelligence cannot understand. So then we have to invoke what we call faith. That there is higher intelligence, there is a higher understanding that is not within my realm right now. But I follow Guru, Sadhu and Shastra. Because in the ultimate picture I know that intelligence is the right intelligence. And it's not easy. It's not easy when the right, that's called the moment of truth, is happening. So we have to build our strength, we have to build our intelligence every day, bit by bit, drop by drop, so that there is something to draw from when situations arise, when circumstances arise. To see if there's something you'd like to add, take the discussion in some direction. Yes, Prabhu.
Appreciation of that is just the most.
The two, both are emotional. There are, well, in the material realm, we are all materially emotional. And then there is the spiritual emotions. Now, for most persons, they look the same. It depends on who's the object. If our emotions are awakened in relation to Krishna, then we're on the right track. For example, let's say the offering was late, or sometimes it was skipped. How do we feel? We can compare. If someone forgot to offer us lunch, we can become very emotional. Someone forgot to offer, let's say, something, lunch or for the deities. How do we feel? Do we have the same intensity of emotions? Someone forgot to whatever, turn off the light, turn on the AC, whatever it is, something, just a whole range of things. Where are our emotions? What do they say? Most of the times it'll be, oh. Or at best we can relate with our experience. It must have been very something. Oh, Krishna must have been hungry today. And then it fades away. But if someone forgot to provide us lunch, we remember that. And we can remember that 20 years later when we see that devotee. Oh, you remember? So that's material emotions. And then there is... So who's the object is important. So what happens is generally emotions come, but the remembrance of who's the object is not active. We forget that we are serving Krishna. We forget that we are Krishna's devotees. Life sort of seems to go on a track, on a conveyor belt, if you will. Just we used to do some other activities. Now we wear different clothes and we have different language and different activities. But in that also we were like zombied out, and sometimes we zombied out here too. Because we had whatever, you know. We didn't sleep well, we didn't eat well, it was too hot, someone said something, something. The mind's distracted in some little corner. So similarly then the emotions don't make sense. We say, well, why are these emotions there? When we have emotions, the first thing to know is who's the object for which these emotions are awakened. They're very simply said in a different way, who's at the center of all of this? And when we find ourselves, then it's frustrating. If the emotions are Krishna related, then that's great. That's very nice. So the practice is, the whole devotional practice is to remove ourselves from the center and center them around Krishna. That's not easy. So therefore there is sadhana bhakti. The intelligence has to remind us, this is for Krishna. Therefore we have big deities, special plates, altar. These are all sacred spaces made so that it's clear. Oh, this is for Krishna. There's a bell, there's a pujari that has to be trained or whatever, and then it's qualified. There are mantras, there is an altar, there's a special kitchen. Everything is done just to remind us that this is Krishna is the center of things. And yet, so easily we forget. Then naturally the emotions don't make sense. They're like, oh, better not to deal with these things. Mostly we're dealing with, you know, a self-centered situation most times. But in relation to Krishna, one may become angry. In relation to Krishna, one may become sad. One may become very happy. And that's nice. That has to awaken. Who's the object? Who's the object around whom all these emotions are awakening? The Mayavadi's track is very easy. It's forget all this. This is all too loosey-goosey, you know, all this, just forget it. Solitude, soham, soham. You know that joke, soham joke? I heard it from Gauranga Prabhu, so I'll say it. There were two roommates. One was a devotee, and the other was undecided what he wants to do with his life. So sometimes he would associate with the devotees, and sometimes he would associate with, let's say, Mayavadis. So the devotee would offer this roommate prasadam and all of that, and try to gently cultivate him. So one day, the other roommate, he visited some Mayavadi program and came back and said, "I learnt a new mantra." I said, "Oh, what is that?" He said, "Soham, soham, soham." Soham means I am that. So aham. So the devotee thought about it and he said, okay, don't change anything in your mantra, just add one syllable to it. He said, what is it? He said, just add da in the front of it. So he said, it became da soham, da soham. He said, oh, this is nice mantra. So he went back to the Mayavadi. So the Mayavadi heard this, he said, what? Dasoham, dasoham? Don't worry, just add one syllable in front of it. Sa, sada soham. I'm always that, I'm always that. He came back to the devotee. And the devotee said, oh. He said, you add a little da in front of that again. Daso, dasoham, daso, dasoham. So finally understood, okay, I've got to be here. So we are the center, soham, soham. We forget, Krishna is the center. Anything else? Yes. A comment and a question.
Two questions.
Oh, that's dangerous.
But do we have time?
Yeah.
So,
I'll tell you if you have time or not after I hear the questions.
Several times, and I'll ask again in a different way.
Okay.
The spin-off of this is, so sometimes, you know, Krishna seems to be in the center. So you were giving examples, you know, practical examples for us, like, oh, the AC was not on.
I know.
Maybe from our conversation, like, because you know, then I feel, personally, I know I feel frustration when I come onto the altar. The air conditioning was not on for the deities and it's hot and small things like that. So it's not a direction, a directed frustration at someone. And yes, the intention is that Krishna should, Kishore should be comfortable and you know, just common sense, practical things. So not on the altar, but anything else also. So when frustration comes in, automatically it's not devotional, I feel. Like, it, how can it be? So how to understand what is the center there? Like, the thought is the deities, but there is frustration.
No, that's okay. That is okay. The deities comfort, when the deities are comfortable and we feel joyful, the deities are uncomfortable and we feel frustration is perfectly devotional emotion.
There should be something else and I don't know what it is. Like,
no, there doesn't have to be anything else. It's okay. What happens is we move from that position. Very quickly we shift. We shift from deity-centered to something else-centered. Maybe it doesn't happen in your case, but it can that some other devotee becomes the object of our frustration or wrath or disappointment, and from them suddenly we become the center. I would not do something. The issue is not whether we had a spiritual emotion or not. The problem is we don't stay there. The mind moves us away very quickly from that position. So the struggle for us is, oh, I had a spiritual emotion. Wow, that's not the issue. The issue is we don't stay. It doesn't stick. It moves very quickly. And because we're habituated, somehow or the other, it turns back to us being the center. And that's where it doesn't, we don't feel good about. Some people feel good about it. It doesn't feel, so then we can't separate the two likes to, oh, I was suddenly thinking about Krishna, I just landed somewhere else. Because the modes of nature kick in very quickly. So the strength of a devotee is to be centered around that emotion without moving into or morphing into a self-centered emotion. That's the issue. Not that I had any... And I can guess the second question. I can say, I think I can seriously guess. It's about higher intelligence, my intelligence. Yeah, I know.
The connect is the devotee is guiding us, spiritual master.
And our faith.
So, our spiritual master is a little different. Like, I feel sometimes like that, sometimes no. Like, it's being recorded, right?
Yeah, can I have an opinion that is different from his view?
No.
Okay.
He does take a stand and he does give very clear directions. Though he says he doesn't sometimes. So, my question is sometimes he takes a stand of a suggestion. And personally, I feel like that is a direction. But at the same time, you know, there may be other inputs, maybe persons who know about it, the suggestion, and you know, they may suggest to me that I have to go with my heart and my decision. And for me, it's very clear that it's not about my decision, it's about the suggestion. And even if my heart is not there, it will be there one day. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Because the caution is always that if we are not going with our heart, then there will always be blame at a later point in time, right?
It could be.
Yeah. So even then, even at a later point in time, one has the capacity, or at least one can choose to, even intellectually or you know through the heart, however, just guide oneself and one mind back to understanding that it was my decision to go with a suggestion and take that as an instruction. You know what I mean?
If that happens in your case, then fantastic. In many cases, that's not how it happens. What happens is by this kind of situation, that in the future, here's the situation. My spiritual master, I'm a bhakta. My spiritual master gave me some indication. In some cases, he tells me, just do this. In some cases, he says, among the many options, this option seems nice. Or he might even say, this is just a suggestion. Whatever, however it comes. According to the textbook example, the disciple says, got it, and I move with it. That's the textbook example. That should be the way. That's nice. However, sometimes I'm just repeating what I understood. And sometimes we are encouraged that hold on, make sure that inside your heart that suggestion makes complete sense to you. Otherwise, express it, because if it doesn't make full sense, oftentimes people right now blindly say Guru Mukha Padma Vakya Chittete Kuriya Aikya, and 2 days later completely get bewildered. It's like, wow, that was such a... I've heard comments such as, that was not at all empathetic, that didn't even consider my situation, or that was not what I was asking for, or something. If not 2 days, 10 years, whatever. Whatever is the time frame. A disciple who's situated properly, even if such a thing does come, can go back and say, well, I had every choice, I had every option to say, I don't think I can follow it, I am not fully under something, but I agreed at that time. That's great. That's fantastic. Oftentimes what happens is, if one has gone further away from that relationship, whatever distance, the mind will say, no. Why do you think many people leave? This is why. No, it didn't make any sense. I was forced into it. Something. There are different varieties of it. Garden varieties of it. That yes, I had a choice, but no, my choice wasn't there. It was given as an instruction. And if I didn't follow the instruction, I'd be committing a great offense. So I had to choose whether I make a big offense or a small offense, and I chose a small offense or whatever. The mind can give any other picture too. So it does happen. It does happen, varieties of things. In the relationship, the disciple or the devotee must be fully awake. Oftentimes, they're not awake. I can't quote who the devotee was, but I'll give you another example. That devotee was doing something, organizing something for all the other devotees. And something got delayed, I think. Yeah, something got delayed. And so all the devotees were waiting. So this devotee who was organizing became very agitated. Oh, it's getting late, all the devotees are waiting, it's an inconvenience to the devotees, etc., etc. So, externally, it seems to be a very devotional sentiment. Oh, the devotees are inconvenienced, they are waiting, something hasn't happened, so they felt very responsible. Their realization was, when they came, where all the devotees were waiting, the devotees didn't mind. They were blissful. They were talking about something, chanting something. And he looked and said, whoa, they're not disturbed. I'm the one who's disturbed. Okay, they're devotees. They're very compassionate. But why am I getting disturbed? Oh, no, because I want to serve the devotees. A little thought, you know, that evening, night, whatever, as time passed, they came to the understanding that my disturbance has very little to do with the devotees. My disturbance, in their case, was my disturbance is all about what impression they have about me. Oh, wow. What was seemingly a devotional sentiment was a very me-centered sentiment. I wasn't really thinking about the devotees. I was thinking about how they will see me. That was a great revelation for them. So many times, I'm taking it back to guru-disciple situation, some instruction is given. There is a big pressure to say yes. Because I want to appear as a very surrendered disciple. Because that's important. My guru has to see me as a very surrendered person. It may not be like a conscious, no, just say yes to whatever he says. It isn't conscious like that. It can be very subconscious. So although if you ask them clearly, is it a yes? They may not be sure, but they have a pressure to say yes. I have to say yes. How can I say no to a guru? It's an offense to like that. But somewhere it will manifest. When it manifests, it depends on how the devotee is situated at that time. They can look back and say, wow, that was silly of me. But anyway, I made that choice. So I'm wherever Krishna has brought me, that's nice. Some people may not see it like that. Some people see it completely differently. Oh, so much time lost. So much is lost. Lamentation. Frustration. Something. So it's a variety of things. So better to be clear now. Or say yes, But don't point finger at backs that you made me say yes or something, you know. Like you said, I have to know this is a choice I made. I took a suggestion as an instruction. I took a piece of advice as, you know, life and soul. But I took that way. That would be proper. Yes. Okay. Anything? Soumya, something? Okay. Okay, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Gotta run. You called me about that the other day.